this morning when nobody asked me for a talk of the title. Actually, as you probably have no idea what I'm going to talk about. It is on. Can you hear me? Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So, this talk is kind of challenging for me. For one, because there aren't all that many people in the world who've ever heard me speak in the world before in the morning. So, I apologize if I'm a bit slow. The other reason is that until 2 days ago, I actually had no idea what this whole program is about. I only returned from a trip very recently, and after I figured out what ISSYP means, I wasn't sure how young is young. So I have a very basic introduction. If I'm too slow for you, then have me some coffee or something. Okay, so I'm going to talk about large Excel dimensions, and the somewhat extended motivation is science has definitely made a lot of progress during the last centuries, and the result of this is that scientific research, the thought of research, has departed more and more from our everyday experience. So all the basic stuff that you can see with your own eyes, like apples falling down, things like this, has been very thoroughly examined. And the result of this is that what historically was one area of science that included mathematics, physics, biology, chemistry, philosophy, all kinds of things, has split up in very many specialized areas. And roughly spoken, what you can do if you want to see something new is you can look closer into the structure of things. And if I mean looking, I don't necessarily mean looking with your own eyes, but possibly with further help. You can look farther away, like stars, galaxies, and so on and so forth. Or you can make things more complicated and ask questions that you would examine, like, you know, what is consciousness? Why do humans behave like they behave? That goes into the direction of biology, maybe neuroscience, things like this. So I believe yesterday you heard a bit about cosmology, astrophysics, stuff like this from Justin. If you want to see Messi, then, well, I recommend you look at his office. What I'm going to talk about is looking closer and closer and see how far we have gone with that. So the obvious first thing that you can do is you use a microscope and put some leaves on it, stuff like this. I believe most of you have probably done that, at least we did that at school. I guess nowadays these things are somewhat more fancy. Probably can take images with the, you can plug them into your computer, stuff like this. So, light microscope, uses light, obviously, that is directed with mirrors and lenses. And what one can typically see on the light microscope is the size of cells or crystals, stuff like this. Besides the hardware constraint that you get from just building this thing, there is a fundamental resolution that you cannot go below that is given by the wavelength of the light. So this is what this plot should illustrate. If you have a structure that is smaller than the wavelength of the light, you just simply cannot resolve it. So what you can do is you can, of course, take light that has a smaller wavelength, that is a higher frequency or more energy. So instead of taking light from the visible range, you can take, you know, ultraviolet, X-rays, things like this. But there's a limit to this where you can sensibly use light microscopes. So what you do then is you can use beams of electrons. We know from quantum mechanics that electrons behave in a certain way as if they were waves. So they have a wavelength as well. This wavelength is given by the inverse of the momentum. The nice thing about electrons is that they are charged. So they are easy to direct with electric and magnetic fields that can basically be used like the lenses in a light microscope. The typical resolution that one can resolve with an electron microscope is about the size of an atom. So this is what you see here. These are some molecules that have been photographed with an electron microscope. So one angstrom is typically the size of an atom. I'm not sure if some of you have ever worked with an electron microscope. No, it's kind of scary. I had to do this for my when I was a student. So you have this huge thing standing there, which looks really intimidating. So the beam has to go through a vacuum. So it's kind of really large, this thing. And the electrons get captured on a fluorescent screen, or one puts a plate in there to take a picture of that. The biggest problem with these things is actually that you have to very carefully prepare your sample. You cannot just take a leaf and put it in and get a photo of it. So what we did in this case, I think we had some magnesium that was lighted and then put on a glass plate, and this we took photographs of. It's nice, it's very interesting. But, well, the thing is, if you want to increase this resolution, the resolution of these things, what you can do is you can accelerate your photons, your electrons. The larger the momentum of the electrons, the better the resolution is that you get. So the next logical step is you accelerate your particles a whole lot. And the particle accelerator. There are two ways you can do that. Either you have a fixed target, which means you have a sample and you shoot your electrons or whatever particles you accelerate on that target. Or you make a collider where you have two beams that collide and you basically measure the beam with the beam. So you examine the particles that you accelerate. Well, and then you look what is left over from the collision, which is not always very easy to do. But it involves a lot of knowledge about the particles that you have accelerated. So you learn something about the elementary interactions that go on in this collision. If you build a particle accelerator, there are two basic things that turn out to be useful. You can either accelerate them linearly, that is, in one direction, or you let them go around in circles. So the first thing doesn't sound too appealing, because the more you want to collide, accelerate your particles, the longer your accelerator gets, obviously. So if you have them go around in a circle, it looks like a better solution. However, the problem is, we know from molecular dynamics that accelerated charges and a motion in a circle is an acceleration, will emit radiation. So if one accelerates charged particles in a circle, they will lose energy. And this energy loss goes with the fourth power of the energy. And it's, well, under proportion to the square of the radius. So the larger the radius of your accelerator, the better. What also goes in here is the rest mass of the particle. So this energy loss of the particle sets a constraint to how useful a circular accelerator can be. What this indicates very strongly is that you possibly use heavier particles, because they have this energy loss will be lower. So the electron is a very light particle. And then what you want to do is you want to take, like, for example, protons that are also charged particles, but they are significantly heavier. So this is what is used today in most accelerators. However, the problem is that we know that proton is not really an elementary particle, but it's built up of smaller constituents. So this is an extra complication to the analysis that one has to take into account there. So this is a simulation of such a collision that you would typically see with, I think this is a collider simulation, actually not a fixed target. So you see a lot of particle beams that go out of the collision region that are detected somewhere, and then one has to trace back these particles and try to figure out what actually happened. This is a photo from the TONSLAG, the Stanford Linear Accelerator. Well, as the name says, it's a linear accelerator. It's an electron-positron accelerator. The particles get accelerated along this line, which I think is about 2 miles long. And then the electrons, well, this is the positron. The positron goes this way, and the electron goes this way, and they collide somewhere here. This thing has also been named, I think, the world most straightest object or something like this. This is a figure from RIC, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider in Long Island, which does not collide very elementary particles, but mostly heavy ions like lead and gold, things like this. So this is why this plot looks kind of messy. In this case, the beam direction would be perpendicular to the plane. It goes in through the middle here, and these regular blanks that you see are features from the detector. So you see all these traces that go out here. The particles in the beam are typically bunched, so the amount of particles that is involved in one of these collisions is about 70 gold nuclei or something like this, which makes for a couple of thousand particles that are detected. It's kind of very pretty, I really like that. Okay, so with these detectors we have achieved to look closer and closer into the structure of elementary matter. You probably all know roughly what the status is today. So we've been able to go beyond molecules to the atom, to the nucleus of the atom and its constituents, protons and neutrons. And we found that also protons and neutrons have a substructure that is quarks. So the current status is depicted here. That's the standard model of particle physics. Well, one could talk about this slide for 2 hours or so. So I just briefly sketch it. We have the quarks that I just mentioned that are strongly interacting and are the stuff that builds up neutrons and protons and all other kinds of hadrons and neutrons. There are the electrons, the electron, the muon, and tauon with the neutrinos. And then there are the exchange particles that mediate the interactions among those. You don't have to understand that in detail. I know there are very many people who really understand all the details of it. And then, let me see, it should be on here somewhere. Then there's, of course, gravity. All right, here's gravity, which, well, it doesn't really belong to this area because it can, at least as far as we know today, not be probed with particle accelerators. So the gravitational force is the only force that is felt by all particles. Then there's the electromagnetic interaction that we all know. There's the weak interaction, that is responsible for beta decay, stuff like this, and the strong interaction that keeps together the stuff that we are made of. As I mentioned earlier, that the stuff that we call particles has also wave properties, so it's a bit misleading if one calls these things fundamental particles. I've had a teacher who suggested one should not name these things elementary particles, but elementary things. But this just sounds too silly. So then what would we call the standard model of things? But one cannot take that too serious if people talk about particles. This is all quantum field theory, so there are no really quantum particles in this theory. It's just that these pictures always seem to suggest this. It's a bit more complicated than this. Yeah, so one mystery of the standard model, let me see if it's on there. I actually didn't look. Is there somewhere on here? No. Well, so the thing is that if one writes down the standard model as we know today, and as we have tested and so on and so forth, then all the particles that are in there are massless, which is kind of annoying because things seem to have mass. So the cure for this is the Higgs. The Higgs is basically just made for this purpose. It gives particles masses. And we have a lot of indirect evidence for the existence of the Higgs, but no direct evidence. And this is one of the things that the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is looking for. Yeah, so the standard model needs the Higgs for consistency, otherwise if one pushes the theory up to higher energies, things start going wrong. And it should become observable around 150 GeV. There are lots of bounds on this. So the currently running Tevatron might just have missed it. So this is what everybody's looking for. This is the section of my talk where I tell you what I'm not going to talk about. So, but I wanted to mention it. Then another thing that people are currently looking for is supersymmetry. The basic idea of supersymmetry is that every boson, that is basically a vector particle, the things that mediate the interaction, comes with a fermion. Like, for example, the gluons that mediate the strong interaction is paired with a gluino, that is a fermion. This is a boson, this is a fermion. The electron has a partner that is a boson, the s electron, and the graviton would have a partner that is the gravitino. So these partners differ by a spin 1/2. And none of these supersymmetric partners can ever be seen. So this is kind of an odd symmetry if you think about it, because if these particles that people hope they exist were actually symmetric versions of the particles that we have seen, then you'd expect them to have the same mass. Just this can't be the case because then we had already seen them. So this means that this symmetry has to be broken at a mass or energy scale that we have not reached yet. So it could be possible that this energy scale where it's broken can be reached at the LHC, in which case it would be possible to produce these partners. And this would probably make a very clear signature, as on the standard model there, most of these processes just don't exist. One thing that I stumbled over when I heard about supersymmetry is the first time is, we have fermions and we have bosons, so why don't we try to pair them with each other? Wouldn't that be much nicer? Well, the one thing is that, in a certain sense, the fermions and bosons in the standard model are paired to each other, because the one is the gauge boson to the interaction of the other particles. But the actual reason is that under the symmetry, the charges are not modified. So you cannot do that within the particle content of the standard model that we already have. This then just doubles the number of particles in the standard model. And this this theory has some nice features. This is why people like it. For one is that some of these supersymmetric particles provide a candidate for dark matter. I'm not sure if Justin mentioned that yesterday. The other reason is that it improves the running of the gauge coupling. I think this is on a later slide. And I will come back to this. Yeah, and of course, you probably know that supersymmetry is required by string theory for consistency, basically. So this is, seems to be a strong indication that there is some truth in that. Okay, so one thing that was not in the picture so far is where's gravity? So the thing why we can't see gravity at particle colliders is that it is much, much weaker than on the other interactions. For example, the ratio between the electromagnetic and the gravitational interaction between two electrons is about 10 to the 43. That means the electric interaction is about 43 orders of magnitude larger than the gravitational interaction. So this is quite a large ratio, and nobody knows why this is the case. So this is also called the hierarchy problem. Why is the gravitational interaction so much weaker than all the other interactions? And this is the plot that I mentioned earlier. What you see here is the inverse strength of the interactions in the standard model and how they change if you increase the energy. So that gravity goes down here means that gravity becomes actually stronger, whereas the strong interaction, you know, it gets weaker. This is what we call asymptotic freedom. And if you trace this running of the coupling constants in the standard model to higher energies, you find in the standard model that they meet in approximately one point that is somewhere around 10 to the 16 GeV. This is pretty much, so I think actually I didn't mention any energy scales. So the current energy scales that can be reached at colliders is about 100 GeV. So 10 to the 16 GeV is much, much larger and very far away from that. So the thing is, in the usual standard model, these curves, well, in a logarithmic plot, they are actually straight lines. They meet somewhere around this energy range, but they do not really meet in one point. You know, the thing is, if one invokes supersymmetry, they meet in one point up to experimental error bars. So this is why people think there has to be something true about supersymmetry, because it has this nice feature. And then if you extrapolate where gravity would come into this game, so this is not actually every side of the computation, this is more a schematic plot, then you'd expect the effects of quantum gravity to become important around 10 to the 19 GeV. This is what is called the Planck scale. And this is very, very far away from what we can reach today at accelerators. However, the question is, of course, can we trust this extrapolation? So this is an extrapolation over, if you start at a TeV or something, like 16 orders of magnitude. 16 orders of magnitude is a lot. That's about what's between the diameter of your DNA and the radius of the Earth. That's 16 orders of magnitude. And if you trust this extrapolation, you trust it to hold over such a reach, over such a such a long region. So I've always wanted to work with quantum gravity, just as a prospect, it's simply kind of disappointing. You know, it's like 60 orders of magnitude away, you know, the test there. And the thing is, if you would want to say, well, the hierarchy problem, well, we don't know why gravity is so weak and why quantum effects would become important only in such a high region, you might ask yourself, why do we actually know that? And the point is, no, we don't know. It could actually be that effects of quantum gravity become important at a smaller energy range. Of course, in this case, you need to have a scenario that would explain why gravity becomes stronger already at smaller energies. And the concrete scenario that can do that are large Higgs dimensions. So this is actually the content of my talk. And these scenarios of large Higgs dimensions can serve to lower the true scale at which effects of quantum gravity become important. And the surprising thing about this is we wouldn't have noticed this yet. But we could potentially observe this in future experiments. Of course, the idea of Higgs dimensions is not new. It has been proposed at the beginning of the last century. Kaluza and Klein were not the first to talk about Higgs dimensions, but they were the first to really work that out. I only want to mention that because it's historically interesting. But one should keep in mind that these scenarios with Higgs dimension that the people talked about today are conceptually different from what Kaluza and Klein tried in these days. So in this modern scenario with Higgs dimensions, the Higgs dimension are kind of an additional feature that the space-time has. Whereas Kaluza and Klein tried to achieve unification of forces through adding these extra dimensions. So they basically tried to, how do I put that? They used the extra dimensions to put additional fields in there because you get more degrees of freedom that can explain some particles of the standard model. However, it did not really work out as they hoped it would, but it was a good try. I still really like these ideas. So I find this idea really appealing because if one thinks about it, nobody really knows why we live in a space-time of three dimensions. So we have a right and a left, a back and a and an up and down. So we have three. this is a sure sign I'm tired if I can only find a German word. So we have three dimensions that we all see. Well, we don't know why this is the case. I mean, why three? Because it's a nice number? So as far as nobody can give me a good reason why we have three dimensions, I'm tempted to ask, well, maybe it might be there are more dimensions. We just haven't seen them yet. Of course, then you have to explain why we haven't seen them. Well, one of the reasons might be that we just kind of go into these extra dimensions. That seems to be kind of a sneaky way out. But well, maybe one has to first specify what I mean with we. So we is basically all the stuff that you are made of, like the quarks and the gluons and the electrons and, well, a certain amount of photons and so on and so forth. So all that stuff would have to remain in these three dimensions. But other stuff that there is, for example, gravitons, things like this, could leave into the sixth dimensions. And we might not have noticed that yet. Or we have never seen something actually vanishing from here into the extra dimension. But with gravitons, we actually don't know because we have just not made the experiment so precisely. However, the thing is that if you consider that gravitons might be able to go to all dimensions, then this modifies Newton's law. Because the 1 over r potential Newton's law depends on the dimensions that you have. If you have three dimensions, you get 1 over r. If you have more dimensions, you get 1 over r to the d plus 1. And this is something that we have not observed before. So what do you, I will have some more details on that on the next slide. What you do in this case, what you have to do in order to be in agreement with what you have already seen, is that you curl these accelerations up to small circles. Mathematicians call that compactification on the torus, but essentially it's just curling these things up to a circle that is so small that we have yet noticed it. Of course, extra dimensions are also required for consistency in string theory. I just want to mention that. However, I'm not a string theorist, but I like to mention this is a good motivation to look into this scenario, but it's not required for what I work in. So what I basically do is I take the standard model as we have it, of particles that there are in, and so on and so forth, and ask, well, what would it look like if we have not three but more dimensions? So one can do that. So the great thing about these scenarios for large extra dimension is that they can potentially explain the weakness of gravity. It could be a result of these compactified extra dimension. So I just mentioned that if you have higher dimensions, then you get a different power law for the Newtonian potential. And this different power law implies that gravity at small distances falls much faster than the typical 1 over r potential that we have. This explains why on larger distances it would appear much weaker than the other interaction that we have, like the electromagnetic, that are bound to our three-dimensional submanifold. That's basically because the force lines of gravity can dilute into all of these dimensions. So if you write that down mathematically, then this is exactly what gives rise to the power in Newton's law. It's basically the surface of the Newton sphere. Since these dimensions are compactified, it means that on large distances, large meaning much larger than the typical radius of the extra dimensions, you would have to recover Newton's law. So this is what is schematically shown in this figure. So this line indicates our three-dimensional universe. I once had to give a public lecture where I said, well, this line is our universe, and everybody started laughing. So I'm not sure if that's maybe too abstract. So this line actually has three dimensions. And the thickness of this line that is magnified here indicates that it's actually curled up extra dimensions. So what you see here is the force lines that a charge, in this case with the charge, I mean actually the mass of the particle. So the mass is something like the gravitational charge. It dilutes faster on smaller distances, distances much smaller than the typical radius. But on large distances, there's nowhere it can go to, basically. So you would have to recover the usual 1 over r potential. So this is the usual four-dimensional potential with the coupling constant that you probably know as g, which is the inverse of mass squared, and this is Planck's constant that I mentioned earlier. And then you have this 1 over r. In higher dimensional space-time, you get a different power law, that is r to the d plus 1. And you need a coupling constant for this. You know what power it needs to have, so this matches up to be an energy. And this new fundamental scale is where you say, well, if there is no hierarchy problem, because that's what we want to get rid of, then this new scale that you introduce here should be somewhere around the energy scales of the standard model that we already know. So it should be somewhere around a TV or something like this. Well, this is basically, it's a parameter of that model. So here one has two parameters, that is this new fundamental scale and the number of extra dimensions. So if you say, well, at larger distances, we have to recover what we have already measured, then you have to assume that these both potentials actually agree with each other. And this gives you a relation between our apparent strength for gravity that we experience, which is given by the Planck scale. And this true fundamental scale, and this relation is given by the volume of the extra dimensions. So if you have a very large volume, then this truer scale can potentially be much lower than the apparent strength of gravity that we observe. So this equation that I have here can be used to get an estimate for how large these extra dimensions would have to be if one assumes that this new fundamental scale is somewhere on the TV or something. And you find if you only have one extra dimension, the radius would be 10 to the 12 meters. That's about the size of the solar system, so this is already outdated, because it would mess up all the orbits of the planets. But already, if you have two dimensions, the radius would only be a tenth of a millimeter. And when these theories came up, it turned out that Newton's law actually had never been tested to so small distances. These theories were proposed in 1999, somewhere out there. Since then, there have been very precise measurements of Newton's law at distances that go into the submillimeter region. This sets constraints on the scenario B equals 2. But if there are more than two extra dimensions, then the radius gets very, very small very fast. And this is out of reach for direct tests with Newton's law. However, this is still within the reach of collider physics. So basically, that's what colliders do as well, right? They go to very small distances. So these things are called large extra dimensions because, well, they are much larger than the Planck scale. The Planck length is about 10 to the minus 20 Fermi. That's really, really small. But they are also larger than this new fundamental Planck scale. So it's, if you look at this equation, it's exactly the fact that this radius is not the inverse of this new fundamental scale that allows you to weaken gravity. So this is a snapshot of the world's largest microscope, the Large Hadron Collider, that is presently being built in at CERN in Geneva. So this dotted line is the border between France and Switzerland. And this is the ring that you see here. It's very impressive. The I think the radius of this thing, the radius is about 28 kilometers. Oh my, so I always forget. I think I have it on a later slide. Yeah, I always like to mention that the CERN was, the internet was invented. It's expected to confirm the Higgs. There are very little people who doubt that the Higgs will be found there. It's hoped for to find supersymmetry. There are other possibilities for like matter candidates that could turn up there, extra dimensions. Or maybe we find something like a quark substructure. There are all kinds of hypothetical theories that could show up there that can be tested. And the whole experiment has been designed to basically expect the unexpected. This reflects in the detectors that they have built and so on. Yeah, the first run is scheduled for May 2008, at least that's what I hope. When I was preparing this talk, I had to shift this date from November 2007 to May 2008. It's kind of funny because since the time I started my PhD, I've always been told like next year the LHC will start. Still the LHC will start, so it's been going like this since, I don't know, 5, 6 years. But well, I hope that next year it will actually start. So they had some kind of a problem with the magnet earlier this year because there was a failure when they tested it. and it basically exploded, so they had to replace a lot of the magnets that were already in the tunnel, and this resulted in this delay. Oh yeah, here are some numbers. So the circumference is 26 kilometers, not miles. The tunnel is 150 meters underground, and the tunnel actually is not new. This is why the construction did not take that long, but the tunnel is being reused from an earlier collider that was in there. It collided two photon beams, each with 70 eV, so they are accelerated in opposite directions and then hit each other in a target. So that means the effective center of mass energy that you get in at the collision region is actually twice this energy. And it will be able to resolve distances as small as 10 to the minus 3 Fermi. Yeah, these magnets that they have there, they have to be cooled considerably, which is a technical challenge. The vacuum is comparable to outer space. I'm always impressed by things like this. You know, I'm a theoretician, so when I was there, you know, you see all these detectors, and this is really impressive. If you get a chance, I encourage you to visit it. One proton makes 11,000 circuits each second, and the beam energy is influenced by the moon and the lake. This is because it basically shifts the whole construction of that thing, and if it's not really optimal, then this influences the energy that the beams can have, and it's expensive. Yeah, you couldn't guess that. So this is how the magnets look like. This is a sketch. So let me see. The beam pipe is here in the middle. So as I said, there are two of these for both directions. Both things in a vacuum. It's super cooled. So the magnets work nicely. This is how it actually looks like. You see again where the beams go through. This is how it looks like in the tunnel. Okay, so this is the largest detector at LHC, which is called Adler. There's a guy standing here. This gives you a sense how huge this thing is. The Atlas cavern is so large that whole Notre Dame would fit in there. I've been in that cavern when they were just about to start putting together the detector. I can tell you it's huge. It's really huge. When I saw these sketches that you see like on the web, something like this, you have no impression how large this thing is. Okay, so now this is a bit more theoretical part then. So I've told you that it would be possible to lower the scale, the true scale of gravity, down to regions that would be accessible at the LHC, and that would mean that it could potentially observe effects of quantum gravity at the collider. So exactly what would these signatures be? Well, one is production of gravitons. If gravity is stronger at smaller distances, that means there are basically more gravitons produced. And these gravitons could leave our three dimension. They could basically go away in these extra dimensions. Also, these gravitons would make contributions to calculation that we do within the standard model because their virtual contributions become important. So this comes into the calculation. It just modifies the results that we have from the standard model. The other very interesting thing about this scenario is that black hole production becomes possible at particle colliders. So before I start with this, here's a word of caution. Adding extra dimension, of course, does not mean that we suddenly know how to quantize gravity. So all these calculations that you can do here work under certain assumptions that are basically like phenomenological models, but it does not mean that you have suddenly quantized gravity. So graviton graviton production you can deal with in a perturbative approach, and one deals with graviton in general relativity or something like that. Yeah, I think I've already said that. Yeah, the important thing about the gravitons as generally of all particles that can experience extra motion is that they will come in towers of masses. The reason for this is that if you have a compactified dimension, then you cannot put arbitrarily wavelength on the circle. So what you get in this case is basically a geometric quantization. That it's essentially the same scenario that you have if you consider standing waves in a box or something like this. This means that the momentum in directions of the extra dimensions comes in discrete steps. On our three-dimensional submanifold, these additional momentum in the extra dimensions looks as if the particle had a mass. Another way to understand it is if you had a massive particle, a massless particle, then you knew that it moves with the speed of light. However, if the particle would move with the speed of light into a direction perpendicular to our brain, then it would look as if the particle moved slower on our submanifold, and you'd conclude that it has a mass. So one can think about this in two ways. You either have a higher dimensional theory, where there's only one particle and the momentum is quantized, or you think of it as an effective theory on the three-dimensional submanifold where you have a whole tower of particles. So this tower of particles also called the Kaluza-Klein tower, with respect to the early ideas by Kaluza-Klein. So in this series, you also have this tower of particles. So the thing is that these gravitons, they are not captured in a detector. Those detectors that you have built there usually are not sensitive to gravitons. So the result of this is a missing energy signal, because these gravitons, they carry ray energy. The question is then, of course, if you don't exactly know what it was, you just know that there's something missing, then how do you find out exactly what the theory is? So this is what is called the inverse problem. If you have a signature that might be somewhat vague, like there's something missing, then you need to know a lot of theory, and you need to do a lot of analysis, and you also need to have a lot of data to find out what the underlying theory was. So in the case of the graviton, it's not actually such a used problem, because it's the only particle that has spin 2. So it, for example, it could not be a gluino or something where we have a different spin. So if you're sensitive to the spin of the particle, then you'd know, well, it was a graviton. So now let's come to what I think is the most interesting thing, is the possibility to produce black holes at the LHC. As I said earlier, within the scenario of extra dimensions, gravity is stronger at smaller distances. So the radius of a black hole is basically the location of the horizon, and the horizon is the point where even a photon can no longer escape. From the gravitational attraction of the object. So if gravity is much stronger, that means that the photon will reach that radius earlier, which means that the black hole is much larger. And it's considerably larger. If you put in some numbers and you compare the radius of a black hole with a mass of about TeV or something, in a scenario with three dimensions, and in a scenario with extra dimension, the ratio is about 10 to the 23. So you gain a factor of 10 to the 23 to this radius. It's kind of unsurprising that in this scenario, the radius of a black hole that has the mass around the new fundamental scale is about the inverse of that fundamental scale. So if the mass is about a TeV, the radius of that black hole would be 10 to the minus 3 Fermi, which is, of course, just the scale that LHC could reach. So what this picture indicates is a parton-parton collision. So as I mentioned earlier, the protons that LHC collides, so the LHC is a hadron collider. The hadrons in this case are protons. They have smaller constituents, most dominantly quarks and gluons. These are usually referred to as partons. So the really elementary collisions that you have at a hadron collider are not the proton collisions, but they are the parton collisions. This makes a difference. So what this indicates is there are two partons that come too close to each other. And if their gravitational attraction is too large, basically if you put too much energy to a too small region of space-time, then the whole thing will just collapse and make a black hole. And that's it. So what I think is interesting, because there's a lot of information in the black hole, they put together, they join together completely different regions of physics. We know that black holes are thermodynamic objects. They have a temperature. This is basically what Hawking told us. There's, of course, general relativity. And I saw on the schedule that you will hear something about this later or tomorrow. There's also quantum field theory that comes into the game through Hawking radiation, thing like this. There's something from the string theory side, something from the loop gravity side. And now there's also particle physics in there. Obviously, if the object emits Hawking radiation, then this radiation will consist of particles. So there's particle physics in there. And what's interesting about this is there are many things that are unknown that about the interaction between these various fields that can potentially be examined with black holes. So if one would understand black holes, one could really learn a lot. So, however, as I said earlier, we still don't know how to do quantum gravity. So if one wants to treat black holes in particle collisions, then one has to make some assumptions. For example, if you want to estimate the collapse probability, so to say, then you just take the approach from classical general relativity. So this is not something quantum fancy or something like this. So it's basically you take your particles too close together, they will collapse. So this gives you an estimate for under which circumstances such collapse will occur. This can be considerably improved if you make things more complicated, for example, by simulating colliding weight packages, and then you see under which circumstances the whole thing collapses, so you basically look for trapped surfaces. This improves this naive estimate, but the improvement is maybe, well, you know, a factor of 5 or something like this, so it's not really significant. As I said earlier, the LHC is a hadron collider, so you actually have to integrate over all these partons that are in there. And the result is that you have far less energies that really go to this highest possible region than you would have if it was a lepton collider. So, you had like muons or something like that, then you actually have all the energy of the beam in that one particle, but for the hadron collider, the energy is distributed to the quarks and all the gluons, and so on and so forth. So I'm not sure how helpful this is for you, but this is the partial cross-section. The cross-section tells you basically something like the probability for a certain process to happen. And you have to integrate over these distribution functions for the constituents of the proton. So this is what comes out. This is the total cross-section So the probability for black hole production to take place, well, it's proportional to the probability, as a function of the center of mass energy. So the center of mass energy for the LHC is 14 TeV, so this would be this point. And the expected production that you get from this is 10 to the 9 black holes per year, which is about one black hole per second. This is quite a lot. And this is also why the LHC has been called a black hole factory. So this other plot shows the partial cross-section of the black hole, that is the distribution of the black holes over the mass. I'm showing you that because it's important to see that this is a logarithmic plot. So it drops very, very fast. Most of these black holes have mass very close by fundamental scale, and there are very, very little of them with the highest energies. They would exist, but they are very rare. I'm mentioning that because if you get the literature, things like that, and you see that people pretend to talk about these with the highest energies because they are the nicest to examine. But the thing is that they are like, well, it's one out of 10 to the 7 or so that actually have this high energies. So one thing that people are always concerned about is, well, we know that black holes are kind of dangerous objects. Well, they sit in the center of the galaxy and they eat all kinds of stars that are around there, and you really don't want to get too close to them because you get sucked in, things like that. So the question is, are these black holes that we could produce that collide as dangerous? And the answer is, to our best knowledge, no. Because we know that black holes have a temperature. The temperature is inverse to the mass of the black hole. If the black holes, like those that will be produced at colliders, have a very small mass, they have a very high temperature. And the temperature that the black holes at the LHC would typically have is around 200 GeV. This is 10 to the 16 Kelvin. This is really hot. So they radiate very rapidly away and are gone within like one fermi over C or something. Well, this is 10 fermi over C, but it's really fast. So they would not even leave the actual collision region. They would be decayed into particles of the standard model before they reach the detector.
How completely sure are we of all the physics behind this? You could turn, like, because we're hypothesized that gravity breaks down when you get like really small scales, like other changes in the law of physics.
Yeah, this is of course correct. So you assume in this case that this semi-classical approximation holds to a certain precision in this case. This is of course not justified if you go to the really late stages, because actually nobody knows what happens if the black hole reaches the Planckian scale. So it is usually assumed that the black hole will make a final decay. I will come to that later. But the point is that if you, even if you say that actually we know what happens in the last stages, we know pretty good what happens if the whole black hole is somewhat larger, like it's a factor 10 above this fundamental scale, then we know the semi-classical approximation works fairly well, and so on and so forth, and we are back into this regime where, you know, the thing evaporates very fast. So if you have a black hole, and let's say you have messed up gravity so much that it does not evaporate fast enough, and stuff would start falling in, then it would grow and it would reach the regime where you know that the approximation is valid. So it could not increase further. But yes, this is of course correct. We don't really know what happens in the end stages here. Yeah, this potential disaster scenario has caused quite a lot of attention. This is an article from the London Times, which was not about the LHC, but it was about RIC, where the potential was discussed that they could produce a black hole, which then would eat up the Earth. This is a follow-up article from a German newspaper, which basically says the same if you don't read German. But I particularly like this illustration. You see here how the black hole produces. It eats up the whole Earth. So it says the black hole sucks in its surrounding and swallows the whole Earth within minutes. It's a dangerous huge volume. So, this guy said, the big question is whether the planet will disappear in the twinkling of an eye. It is astonishingly unlikely that there is any risk, but I could not prove it. But the thing is, one can't prove it. So the mass loss of these things is about, as I said earlier, several hundred GeV per fermion C. And if you estimate the amount of mass that the particle could gain by traveling through something, even if you take the most dense medium that you can think of, so this is actually not a very dense medium, but quark gluon plasma, think about the center of a neutron star, something like this, the possible mass gain that black hole would have is about more than 10 orders of magnitude smaller. And even if you assume it had a very high gamma factor, it is traveling very fast, like something that you could imagine if you had a black hole coming from outer space, hitting a neutron star, something like this. Even this would not be sufficient for the black hole to grow. So this gamma factor is basically, it's an effect of special relativity. You know, the thing travels very fast, it experiences a different the time scales get squeezed together, so it actually would evaporate much slower. On the other hand, you could this is from the rest frame of a neutron star. On the other hand, you could go into the rest frame of the traveling object, and then it would experience the neutron star is much denser. Either way you turn it, you gain this gamma factor from the relative motion between the object and the plasma. But either way, it's not sufficient for the thing to go. Which, is of course what you would expect, because as far as I know, no one has ever seen a neutron star suddenly collapsing and vanishing into a black hole. And, one can make estimates on how often this should happen if that was the case. So here we come to the black hole evaporation process. The first thing that happens if you collide your two particles together and they form a horizon is that this was the object, it tries to become a decent black hole. And we know that there's something like the no-hair theorem for black holes, which says black hole is basically characterized by three quantities, that is, the mass, the charge, and the angular momentum, so everything else has to be radiated off. That is all kind of higher multiple moments, things like this. This is, for obvious reasons, then called the balding phase. Then there's the Hawking phase, in which the black hole makes this thermal radiation into all particles of the standard model. This also includes gravitons. Again, these gravitons can potentially leave our submanifolds and are not detected, which leads to a missing energy signal. The characteristics of this, especially of the temperature, depend on the number and the size of the extra dimension. That is, if you could measure that, if you could measure the thermal spectrum, then you could determine these parameters. This is what's so interesting about this. And then if the black hole has shrunken down to a size that comes within the Planckian region, then nobody really knows what actually happens. It is generally assumed that the black hole will make a final decay in some few particles of the stellar model, but we actually don't know. So some people like the scenario that there is a stable remnant left over that has no temperature and just sits around. This solution is favorable for some reasons, but there are more reasons not to favor it. But the point is nobody really knows. So. What experimentalists do is they examine what signatures both scenarios would lead to, and then, we just have to measure on the black holes and then we'd know, right? Okay, so this is what a black hole event at BLHC would look like in contrast to what quantum chromodynamics would suggest. So here we have again these two partons that get close enough to each other. So within the Swinner model, they would make an interaction. Say they would exchange a gluon, something like this, and they get scattered and produce an outgoing jet. That is, you have two particles that will move out of the collision region with very, very high energies. And these things will hadronize and form what is called a particle shower. So this is a very typical signature that you have. It's called jet. So if quantum gravity would become important in this region, then it would look completely different. These two things will get too close to each other. And then they would collapse, make a black hole. And the black hole would then emit all kinds of particles. Some of these would also produce jets. But we know what the thermal distribution of these is, and they would produce these things into all directions. So it is a very clear signature that could easily be extracted from the data. And what experimentalists do now, since the first run of the LHC has been postponed again, is they run simulations. And that is basically they make fake data, and then they run their code over this data and see if they can figure out what was put in the beginning. So it's basically an exercise. And it turns out that black hole events can be reconstructed very well if one can extract the parameters of the model from that. However, now I'll start with telling you how we try to look closer and closer into the structure. And now if you think about it, whenever you try to get your particles too close together and they come into this quantum gravity region, then they will form a black hole, and that's it. So there is no final resolution that you can achieve there. In particular, quantum gravity, or all approaches of quantum gravity that we know today, seem to indicate that there's something like a fundamentally finite resolution in our spacetime that is given by the Planck length. So this is actually what I'm working on right now. So the question what would be the signatures of this fundamentally finite resolution that our spacetime has. So this will be the topic of another talk. But the question that you can then ask here is this the end of short distance physics? If we have reached this regime, there is no point in going to smaller structures because it just cannot be done. Okay, so I'm not finished. Of course, these models with extra dimensions, they are not really fundamental theories or anything like this. They have a lot of problems that cannot be answered within these models. So this is just a model to examine the phenomenology of what it would mean if our space-time had extra dimensions. But of course, there are lots of open questions within the standard model. Why are the particle masses what they are? Why three generations and families? Yeah, and of course, why are there three large dimensions that we observe? Or why these interactions and so on and so forth? They could have continued with this all the way down. So this is basically what the next generation will do. So instead of summarizing what I've just said, I just end with that quotation. Thank you. You mean the existence itself or the value? Within this scenario, yes, because the value of the fundamental scale is dependent on the number of extra dimensions. So this was the relation that I showed you earlier.
Okay. Okay. Yesterday, we were speaking to a small man, he said something about triply spectral relativity. I'm not quite sure what that is, but I mean, that talks about like a fundamental, I guess from spectral relativity, if we get like a fundamental velocity, is that fundamental behind the
value? Well, I'm still building with the doubly special one. yes, of course, that's correct. It goes to the same region. So the way that I think about theories with this minimal length is not exactly the same thing that it's not exactly the same way that we think about. Let me put it like this. But it goes into the same direction. So if you have something like a fundamentally finite length, then this, of course, means that you will have to modify special relativity because I don't know how much you know about special relativity, but you have this funny thing that length scale get contracted if you boost them. So if you have a minimal length and you boost it, you don't want it to get contracted because then it wouldn't be minimal to begin with. So you have to modify something about special relativity to make that work. And this is where this comes into the game.
You said that if a black hole were created, it would evaporate within 10 to minus 22 seconds. How could you actually tell if a black hole was created if it evaporates that fast?
Well, from the signature. So this is basically then the task of the data analysis. So if you had the standard model just in this region that LHC would probe, you can make predictions about the amount of particles and their momentum distribution and so on and so forth that you'd expect to come out there. Now, if you produce a black hole somewhere in between, the signature would look different. So for example, these jets that I just showed you, they just would not exist anymore because whenever you start up with a configuration that would have made a jet in the usual theory, you now make a black hole. And what you get instead is not this back-to-back correlation, but you get a thermal distributed spectrum. So this is a very clear signature that you could find out of the data.
What about like the black hole information column, sort of like the fact that like when you put information into a black hole, sort of gets lost? Is that something you could sort of study if you were to make black holes, or are those like
that's one more tool. Yeah, that's one of the most troubling unsolved problems, I would say. That it, and this is also the reason why some people prefer the remnant scenario solution, because well, you could use the remnant to just store the information in there.
Great.
But yeah, I mean, if you produce a black hole and you know what it was made of and you measure what comes out of it, then you could try to figure out what actually happened to the information. So you would have an experimental grip on it. That's what makes it so exciting.
Yeah.